We're now firmly in the era of exoplanetary astronomy, where we know of thousands of planets orbiting around other stars, and the variety and complexity of the planets that astronomers have been discovering is just beyond anyone's expectations. We see hot Jupiters, we see rocky worlds orbiting around red dwarf stars, and of course the dream is eventually to be able to find that other Earth orbiting around a sun-like star. Now, much of this work has been done by missions that are doing large surveys like Kepler and TESS, but you're also having James Webb and the Hubble Space Telescope that are observing these exoplanetary systems to understand. Now, that gets you infrared, that gets you visible light, that even gets you into the ultraviolet, but there is a part of the far ultraviolet that can give really important information about the escaping atmosphere coming from these exoplanets. And this is a field that astronomers would like to learn a lot more about. My guest today is Dr. Emily Rickman. She is an ESA astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute. She works with a bunch of the space telescopes, Hubble, James Webb, but also was the project manager for a mission concept called the Mission to Analyze the Ultraviolet Universe, or MOVE. And this is a probe-class mission, think of like a billion-dollar-ish mission, that potentially could investigate that far ultraviolet part of the spectrum that would give you really interesting information both about exoplanets, about planets here in the solar system, as well as other places of kind of extreme ultraviolet spectrum out there in the universe. Now, we talk about the MOVE concept and what ultraviolet gets you in terms of planetary science, but then also we talk a lot about direct imaging, which is really Emily's specialty. What is it going to take for us to directly observe Earth-sized worlds orbiting around sun-like stars, as well as just the other interesting exoplanets that are out there? So enjoy this conversation with Dr. Emily Rickman. Emily, we're all familiar with infrared astronomy, thanks to everything that's happening with James Webb. We're seeing discovery after discovery. But what can we learn from ultraviolet astronomy, which is different from infrared, invisible light, any other spectra that we are familiar with?
Yeah, so UV is really powerful because that's where a lot of the really highly energetic things are happening in the universe. So the things that we really cannot capture with the infrared, with the visible, and things that are really exciting events, so big explosive energetic events that we just don't see as bright in those infrared and visible wavelengths. So it's really important to capture what's happening in the UV to really get a scope and understanding of like the diversity of wavelengths and what's happening at all of these different wavelengths. And they each tell a different part of the story.
And so if you could swap out your eyes with ultraviolet eyes, what could you see in the universe? What would it look like?
Oh, you would see all of the really exciting explosions that that are happening or have happened in recent, at least recent on astronomical timescales. You would see things like atmospheric escape on planets. You would see perhaps active aurora on more locally within our solar system on planets like Jupiter. So lots of these really exciting energetic events happening in the universe. But we also have to be careful because UV detectors are actually often quite sensitive. And so we actually don't want to look at things that are too bright and accidentally fry the detectors on board our telescopes. So that's something we actually have to take into consideration when we observe these kind of things. Because there's so much energy from these wavelengths, it becomes quite a fragile thing. So we actually have to protect our detectors when we do these kind of observations.
So I didn't realize that. Okay, so I mean, there are these classic images taken by both Hubble Space Telescope and James Webb where you can compare them, right? With James Webb, you can actually see through the gas and dust to see the stars and such forming inside. With Hubble, with ultraviolet, you're seeing those really bright stars. And so how do we mitigate the damage to the telescope potentially if we're going to look at those really bright regions?
Yeah, so one of the important things is the number of photons that reach our detector in a given amount of time. So we discuss this in terms of counts like per second. And there's basically a limit of any UV detector of how many photons can be received into that detector at a given time. Otherwise, you can basically fry your detector and you don't want to be doing that. So we know these limits. These are well-defined. And we also have a buffer So, you know, there is sort of a leeway room within there that we know. And when you're planning your observations as an astronomer, you have to make sure that you're under that count limit, essentially. So if you're interested in looking at a bright target, that might mean using a certain observing setup. So it's a certain filter or a certain grating or a certain exposure time. That means that the counts that you're receiving are not so high that you're in that risky category that might end up causing some damage that doesn't need to be done. And actually, it's part of my job as someone who works for Hubble to assess these programs and make sure that we don't go over those limits and that our observers are within that safe regime.
So, like, when I do astrophotography and I'm looking at some really bright object and you get this sort of oversaturation where one part of the CCD fills up and goes into the neighboring regions, then that means that you can't sort of see one specific part. But like you're saying that, in fact, if you get more and more exposure, it's actually causing damage to the underlying electronics.
Yeah, exactly. So, so we have CCD on Hubble as well. And the CCD, exactly as you say, that these buckets, the photons fill up their buckets and can overspill, and then you're in that saturated regime. And although that's less than ideal, that doesn't necessarily cause damage. You might have instrumental effects like persistence, where if you take an image of a really bright object and saturate the detector, if you then take a follow-up observation, you might see these sort of ghosts that are persistent from a previous observation where you've been staring at a really bright object, but they're not damaged. They go away with time, and these are known artifacts. Whereas on the UV side, the detectors are quite different. And I will admit I'm not enough of a detector expert to go into the physics of it, but you don't have the same physics that's required like in a CCD, where you essentially have a bucket that fills up with photons, but rather if you go above a certain count rate of photons, you actually just reach a point where the detector will not behave and will essentially get fried. Yes. So it's a little bit different. Yeah.
Okay. That's really interesting. I mean, I know that you can't get a sort of a traditional telescope mirror with the higher end of the spectrum, when you've got sort of a dish that's reflecting infrared light or visible light, but with X-rays and gamma rays, you have to switch to a different methodology. Is there sort of like a place where UV fits along that range?
Yeah, right. And even within the UV, there's quite a wide wavelength range. And we talk about different aspects of the UV regime in itself. So that there's the extreme UV, the far UV, and a near UV. And so with Hubble, we kind of capture the far UV, or FUV for short, and then near UV, or NUV for short. But with MOV, or MOV, as our American viewers will call it, that's when we really probe into the extreme UV. That was part of this proposal for this mission. So even within the UV itself, there's quite a wide wavelength regime. And as you say, you also can go down to the X-ray and gamma ray, and then you really start talking about different detector physics and the ways that we capture those really important wavelengths as well.
All right, so I think we've jumped to the part in the conversation, which is why I originally reached out this idea of MOV. I forget how we pronounce it in Canada. You know, we're still part of the British Empire, sort of. And do we pronounce it like the Americans? I'm confused now.
It was a source of discussion on our team. I was the only foreign national. Everyone else was from the US. And so it became a bit of a contention, friendly contention. Yes.
But you held your ground. You didn't let it bleed into your brain and change the way you pronounce it. So what is this?
Yeah, so MOV, or MOV, is stands for the Mission to Analyze the Ultraviolet Universe. In astronomy, we love a good acronym, so it's not too bad of an acronym, actually. But the idea is that it's a pro-class mission that was designed as part of the inaugural NASA Astrophysics Mission Design School. So just to give a bit of context to that, so NASA hosts these mission design schools every year, and they usually alternate between planetary science, so missions and probes that would look at planets within our solar system, and also heliophysics, so things focusing on looking at like solar physics, for example, and our sun. But they hadn't done an astrophysics mission design school before. And so this was the first year that they decided to do it. And it's a pretty extensive program. It lasts a few months and it brings together a team of people who, some with more of an expertise in science, some with more of an engineering background, and basically become a mission design team to pull together a hypothetical proposal for a mission. And that's what this mission ended up being. And so we essentially identified a science area that could be captured by a mission that maybe isn't currently capturing that kind of science to the extent that would be needed to answer the questions that we were interested in. And we came up with a few different science questions and sort of based these to come up with hypotheses of how we would answer those questions. And then that's how MOVE came to exist as a concept and was our response to that. And that also included, you know, assessing what the current missions are, either previously or ongoing or potentially future missions as well. But we identified that there was this area that wasn't quite being captured at the moment in the extreme UV. And that became a real focus of this mission design.
So help me understand this. Like, where is the UV spectrum? And does this fall outside of the ability of Hubble?
Yeah, a little bit. So the extreme UV, as we've identified it within this mission concept, is when within like 50 to 120 nanometers. So this falls a little bit more extreme than what Hubble covers. And also to be clear as well, this mission concept wasn't like to replace Hubble, but more so to be complementary to the science that Hubble does and other UV missions as well. But Hubble is the big one. And it's to kind of just push down in that wavelength regime at the resolution that MOVE would look at, which is about R of 1000 in spectral resolution, which I will also note is a lower resolution than Hubble. I don't want this whole thing to become into a big comparison between Hubble and MOVE, but there's certain aspects that are, you know, that are complementary to Hubble. So, and sort of are perhaps better or worse or different specifications to what Hubble provides in its science.
Okay. So I understand that Webb is a larger telescope and it uses the infrared. It has this larger collecting area, but that also infrared is sort of slower and more difficult to be able to produce an image. And so do you have sort of like a similar situation with ultraviolet? Like, how does the size of the mirror compare to sort of the expected outcome of your observatory?
Ideally, you always want a bigger mirror just so that your sensitivity is higher. Like in an ideal world, given infinite money and resources, you would have a giant, giant mirror because that is really about capturing the sensitivity. So that's what one of the really key things in going bigger. And it's, and bigger is always better in that sense because then you can just capture more photons. So, but in this particular case, because this is like a probe class mission, there is a restriction on the amount of hypothetical money that would be poured into this. And that puts a restriction on how large your telescope can be as well, like with any project, including Hubble, including JWST.
So when you say a pro class, what are the restrictions that are put on?
So the pro class within NASA is a $1 billion mission. So just to put that in comparison, so JWST is what's part of NASA flagship. So these are the very large missions that get designed over a number of years, a number of decades even. It's a concept that would have been designed for the past 30 years at least for JWST, and similar for Hubble, and soon for the Roman Space Telescope that will be launched in a couple of years from now. So those flagships are really an order of magnitude higher. So there's something like $10 billion. And that's really, and also with contributions from other space agencies. So like the European Space Agency that I work for example, whereas these smaller class missions, and I say smaller, they're not small, they're still like $1 billion. That's still a lot of money. That's what we kind of call the probe class missions. So these are missions that are designed by scientists and science teams, and they usually have like a principal investigator, a PI, who will be based at like a US institution who's interested in answering a particular science topic and maybe some auxiliary science that's associated with that. And NASA will put out a call asking the community to say, hey, you know, we're interested to hear the input from the astronomical community. What kind of science questions would you like to answer? And that's when a science team with a PI will put forward their idea and say, this is what we're interested in answering. And in order to answer this, these are the kind of requirements that would be necessary. So that might be spectral resolution, might be mirror size, might be wavelength range, or what kind of detector you would need in order to answer that. Might be imaging versus spectroscopy, or both potentially. But you really are sort of narrowed down in that probe class by the budget. It's always by the budget. And that's really what defines the probe class. Yeah.
It's funny that people are excited about various missions, but they don't realize the scale of the mission. Are they a flagship class? Are they a discovery class? Are they a probe class? Like, a classic example of this is the TESS mission, which has found a ton of new exoplanets and actually is a fairly low budget mission. So it's a probe class, not a flagship. And yet there were these flagship missions like Kepler, which delivered a tremendous amount of science. So were you going into this trying to figure out, like, what are the kinds of scientific outcomes that we can produce with a spacecraft of these constraints?
What we did was looked at what's called the ASTRO 2020 Decadal Survey. And this is a report that comes out from the astronomical community about once every 10 years, hence the name. And it's basically a big survey of the astronomical community that are asked to put forward white papers to say, hey, this is a science question that's really important to me and what I work on. How can we answer that? And what resources and what facilities are we missing in order to answer that? And so we used that 2020 Decadal Survey as a starting point to say, these are the big questions that the astronomical community are asking right now and have listed as their priorities. So there is a committee that takes on board all of these white papers, looks and sees maybe what the recurring themes are, like what maybe there's a substantial number of white papers covering a similar topic. And that committee compiles all of those things into one large report that anyone can go and read if you're interested. It's a very large document, but if you want some bedtime reading, go ahead and read it.
I've skimmed it. You know, do a keyword search for habitable worlds.
I love that that's what you brought up, so we can definitely talk about that. So it's basically presented by the National Academy of Sciences, and we use that as a starting point to say, this is what the committee have highlighted as the priorities and the broad questions that the astronomical community would like to answer. And of those topics, which ones would we want to focus on? Which do we think are important? And which ones can we also sort of clump together in a way? Because not all wavelengths are going to answer all questions, because you're probing different physics. So if you're going to focus on one wavelength, then you're going to start answering a cluster of questions that might not answer another cluster of questions that you might need a different wavelength range for, like the infrared, for example. So the things that our team highlighted that we were interested in happened to sort of be in this UV realm. And then that ended up being a couple of topics covered by the ASTRO 2020 that ended up being the questions that we wanted to answer for this mission.
So when you think about a mission like James Webb or Hubble, you have these science goals. You're trying to look into regions where new exoplanets are forming, or you're looking at the very beginning of the universe. So what were the science goals that you were looking to put into MOVE as you were doing this design?
Yeah, so I'm going to focus mostly on the planetary ones because that's what my expertise is. But the some of the science questions that we really had in mind were related to looking at atmospheric escape of exoplanets. And this, in order to do this, you specifically want to look at the Lyman Alpha line, which exists in the sort of border between the extreme UV and far UV. So you really need the UV wavelength range in order to do that. So basically, that's looking at transiting exoplanets. So as a planet transits in front of its host star, you can assess the atmospheric properties of that star. And a lot of the work that goes on in the infrared, for example, looks at the atmospheric composition of the planet. You can also do this in the UV as well. But you can also assess if the atmosphere of that planet is escaping. And that really presents itself in that Lyman Alpha regime. And so one of the really key topics that we were looking at with the MOAN mission was answering, looking at, do we see escaping atmospheres? And what could that mean for the habitability of planets that we're looking at, helping us assess where could we potentially find life in the universe? You have to understand the kind of environments that these planets exist in. If you are trying to look at rocky planets around M dwarfs, like the TRAPPIST system, for example, or any kind of planetary system for that matter, then you really need to understand what the impact of the star and how that might impact the atmosphere of the planet orbiting that star. Obviously, if you're losing the atmosphere of the planet that you are actively trying to live on, that's not a good sign for life. So these things really help us understand habitability.
I mean, if we could build a time machine and go back in time and look at Venus, Earth, and Mars at the beginning of the solar system and then watch as they progress through time and we see how Venus becomes drier, how Mars loses its atmosphere, but obviously we can't do that. But maybe there's a way we could see this happening in other star systems.
Exactly. And actually, often using these space telescopes is really a way for us to sort of treat them as a time machine in a way. Not only are we looking back, potentially when we're looking in the outer reaches of the universe, we are almost looking back in time because of the amount of time it's taken for that light to arrive at us, but also in the way that you're absolutely right. It's like comparative planetology. When you're looking at other systems, you can, if you're looking at a system younger than our own solar system, then you can start to hypothesize, is this similar to how our solar system looked like at that moment in time? And now we're at this point in time, could that system that we're looking at comparatively end up looking like our solar system or not? These are some of the questions that we're trying to answer. You do also have to take into account different spectral types. So our star is a certain spectral type. Some of these planets that we look at are orbiting around stars that have different spectral types. But they're also really important for us to understand more globally, like how these planets form and evolve and what their atmospheres look like. But you're absolutely right. It would be fascinating to be able to look back in time on our own planets, especially our own terrestrial planets here, and understand how their atmospheres evolved.
And so what kind of limiting spectral types are you looking for? Is it more like red dwarfs or stars like the sun?
It's more so with atmospheric escape, it's more of a question of how close the planets are to the star, because ones that are highly irradiated by from the UV from the star itself are going to be very hot planets that are more likely to show signs of these atmospheric escape. But things like M dwarfs, which is what the TRAPPIST star is, an M dwarf, you have to be careful with those spectral types, because they M dwarfs are very active. They have a lot of activity going on in the star. They have a lot of flaring. And these high energetic events like flaring that we see on M dwarfs can cause things that we believe to cause things like atmospheric escape. So that's very different to our own sun, that is quite honestly a pretty boring star. I love the sun, but it's not very exciting. It doesn't have a lot of these.
What has it done flares for us lately? Yeah.
which is good for us, because it means that we exist here and we live here, and that's good. But it's really important for us to understand these other spectral types, and especially these highly energetic spectral types like M dwarfs.
But could you use this as a method of planetary discovery, that you're seeing the atmospheric escape, and so you're able to infer the presence of a planet?
So we see the atmospheric escape during the transit of the planet itself. So I couldn't envision that we would just see atmospheric escape without already having seen the planet or seen the transit of the planet. So I don't see it as a way to discover planets, unless there's anyone watching this who has a really excellent idea of how we could implement that. I would love to hear from you. But it's more of a way of, we go from detecting planets to characterizing them, right? So not only discovering them, but actually understanding what their properties are, and that includes their atmospheres.
But the other thing that you mentioned is being able to detect auroras on exoplanets.
Yeah, so I'm not sure the sensitivity that would be required to do this for exoplanets, but we certainly see this in our own solar system. So for example, in Jupiter, we see this active aurora in the UV. That was actually something that was quite unexpected when this was first discovered. This is still something that I think the sensitivity of seeing this on exoplanets with them being so far away might be quite difficult. But I think this is something that we could definitely think about in the future. And I know, again, different wavelength regime with JWST, but we actually do see some, we see this on brown dwarfs where we're seeing aurora that could be caused by like a sort of equivalent of a moon orbiting around a brown dwarf.
Yes, I know that story, yeah.
Right, and so that's a really exciting case. And we could, if we had the sensitivity, then that could be something that maybe we could see as well, yeah.
I like this idea of potentially detecting exoplanets by the emissions from the magnetosphere of the planet. You know, perhaps you put a radio telescope on the far side of the moon, it's protected from emissions from the Earth, and so it can look out and see these auroras interacting with the solar wind of the star, and that tells us that the planet is there. And, you know, maybe there's a version of that where you could do that with ultraviolet, but I can see that maybe that's a flagship and not a probe.
Yeah, and I think it's something to think about for a future flagship. But yeah, I think the sensitivity of something like MOVE just wouldn't, given the size of it being a probe class mission, I just don't think would be substantial enough to get those kind of observations.
I've done a lot of reporting on the LIFE mission, the Large Interferometer for Exoplanets, and they've got two modes. Like, one mode is they can examine known exoplanets, but the other mode is they can start to search for potential candidate exoplanets so that they could then study further. And so do you think that we're going to have to get to this place where we've run out of candidates, we're going to have to build a Kepler-2 to do this really wide-scale search for more potential candidates to then hand over to those detailed telescopes like LIFE or HWO?
So I think right now we are still actively looking for all of those candidates. So, you know, like I said, Kepler has been a part of that. TESS continues to be a part of that. And Plato will also be a part of that as well. But I think, like, yeah, there are lots of missions that are really sort of looking for those candidates right now. So you think by the time that Habitable Worlds will be getting close to a real concept and a real design and a real mission, we're still talking like decades at this point. So, you know, we've still got a lot of science to do between now and then when that actually gets refined in order, like, what will we look at? Roman is going to have such a huge impact on this. Like, the number of exoplanets that Roman is destined to find is going to be really impactful. And I don't know if the community is even ready for that. In terms of that, I think that's really going to shape the discussion around what the candidates might be for Habitable Worlds. I think we're still a little bit premature in having that discussion right now, if I'm honest. You know, we are basing it on what we currently know. And also bearing in mind as well, it's not just space missions. I mean, there's a lot of ground-based work that's going on complementary to space-based missions as well. So the radial velocity technique is very powerful in monitoring planets over a long period of time. And there are many different facilities around the world that are doing this. And this is really important to do this high precision or extreme precision, even radial velocity from the ground. And that's being used as precursor measurement technique in order to select the candidates that we may ultimately end up observing with Habitable Worlds Observatory. So I think we're still relatively early days in terms of what the target list might look like for Habitable Worlds Observatory. I know there are some preliminary target lists that have been sent around and are a really good starting point for that discussion. And it's not to say that those targets will or will not be observed. It's just a starting point for the discussion. But I think Roman is going to change so much. Like, I really do think that. So I'm very excited to see over the next 5 or so years, like, what that's going to look like after it launches.
Yeah, I've reported on these target lists, and it's like a really nice list of, like, it's a good planet, it's around the right kind of star, it's in a nice orbit, but we don't know for sure that this really is an Earth 2.0. I want to go back to talking about direct imaging because, you know, with the transit method, you can only see when the planet is passing in front of a star. With the radial velocity method, it gives you a little leeway. You know, you're measuring the movement of the star as the planet is pulling it around with its gravity. With astrometry, you can see the planet when it's sort of moving and making the star form a little circle in the sky. But direct imaging would let us see all of the orientations. You just block the light from the star and then you see all the planets. I want to see all the planets. What would it take for us to see all the planets?
Time, money, resources.
Coronagraphs.
Coronagraphs. I mean, the biggest limitations with direct imaging is really the contrast that we can achieve between the contrast of the stellar host, so the star that the planets are orbiting around, and the planets themselves. So direct imaging really lends itself to more massive, more luminous planets. So if you're more massive, you give off more light, more flux, it's much easier. You're in a much easier contrast regime in order to directly image those things. Planets are also much more luminous when they're younger, so it lends itself to much younger systems, which is the opposite of what the radial velocity method typically favors older systems, because you want to look at stars that don't have a lot of stellar activity because you're looking at the star itself. But really, actually, a lot of the things I work on are very complementary in nature. And so high contrast imaging, I would say, is my realm and my expertise. But I use a lot of radial velocity observations and astrometric observations to as precursor to find the targets that I then go on to directly image. And that's really powerful if you can combine all of these techniques, because you start removing some of the limitations of each of those things and actually use that to your advantage to understand the systems that you're looking at, and really understand the things like the masses of the planets that you're looking at and the orbital configurations of the planets that you're looking at, which you need more than one observation technique in order to do that, because there are too many unknowns if you just use one technique. But imaging, our limitations are the coronagraphs. And there's a lot of technology development that's going on right now. I mentioned previously the tech demo for Roman for the CGI coronagraph, but there's a lot of future technology development that's going on beyond even what Roman's doing, but what a future coronagraph might look like to get down to those really extreme contrast ratios to start looking and imaging potentially terrestrial planets. And then that's when things are going to get really exciting.
I've asked people this question before and I've been told no, but I'm always going to just keep trying. So we think back at Kepler, right? He was looking at this wide field of view, watching all of these stars to see if any of them dim. When you think about Gaia, it's watching all of these stars and watching to see if any of them have this telltale signature of a planet moving the star. But is there an analog in direct imaging where you could just like look at a whole bunch of stars all at the same time and see if any of them have planets moving around them? You know, is there a way to quickly sort through that haystack to find the needle, or do you have to like pick up the hay one piece at a time?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because we do have to take on this very targeted approach just because of the nature of the observations. If you have one coronagraph that you can put over one star, then, and you also need to stare at the system for a very long time in order to get the sensitivity required, in order to pick up the photons from the planet orbiting the star. I'm not sure what a potential architecture of a mission would look like in order to, or architecture of a telescope would look like in order to do like a multi-target approach to chronographic imaging. There's also non-chronographic imaging where you don't reach the same sensitivity, but you could potentially envision a wider field of view trying to just capture images of companions around stars without a coronagraph, but the sensitivity there really wouldn't be substantial. And actually, you'd probably just capture a lot of binary systems, which is something we already do with a lot of other telescopes. But that's an interesting point. One of the other things as well, because of the observational setup of doing coronagraphic observations, is you really require the angular diversity. And what I mean by that is when you take an observation, you want to take an observation at one angle and then at another, and you use both of these angles in our data processing techniques in order to increase the sensitivity that we get of these observations. And because that is unique to each system that we look at, I don't know how you would take that into account to do this across multiple stars at a given time.
I mean, I see hints of it. I think about, say, the Very Large Telescope has this sphere instrument that allows it to measure the polarized light that comes from the atmosphere of an exoplanet compared to the light that's coming from the star. And you can imagine if you could observe this wide field of the sky and only look for that polarized light that would tell you it was coming from the planets themselves. But, you know, I'm just sort of thinking this through.
Yeah, that's a good point. And maybe the other way you could think about it is if there was a way that we could look for a unique atmospheric feature that you wouldn't expect to see on a star, but you'd only expect to see on planets, and you would just be able to pull out that very specific molecular feature, for example, that could show you hints of where planets are existing without having to rely on, kind of similar to that polarized light aspect, but just looking for features that are unique to planets that we don't see on stars. But again, the issue you'd run into is the sensitivity of doing that.
You know, we're back to atmospheric escape. Like, maybe there's a way to perceive the atmospheric escape coming from all of these stars. Anyway, I will keep asking the question, and I'm sure like somebody will eventually say, oh yeah, no, we could just do it with a quantum computer.
Yes.
Pick up a quantum computer, yes, and it'll be done.
That's always
tomorrow.
The answer.
I actually had a chance to talk with Lee Feinberg about quantum computers in our interview, and he's really excited about it. Like, he's one of the main people behind both James Webb and the Hubble Space Telescope. And I think, you know, if he's excited about quantum computers, then maybe that's what comes next. Emily, what are you obsessed with right now?
So I've kind of hinted to this a few times, but for me, it's so, yes, I love discovering planets, but for me, it's really understanding the planets that we look at. So understanding their atmospheres, understanding what's going on within the layers of the atmospheres. So for the first time, we're starting to see like silicate cloud features directly on planets for the first time, and starting to get these real hints of things like disequilibrium chemistry happening on these planets. And I am obsessed with really understanding what the atmospheric processes are of these planets and how we understand them. So that's really where my avenue is going right now. And I'm really excited to start learning more about these planetary atmospheres.
There's this quote that resonates with me that the universe is weirder than we can imagine, that, you know, astronomers are looking for things and then stuff just pops up that nobody ordered. And so when you're making these observations, are you surprised at what you see?
Yeah, I think we're definitely starting to see molecular features on some of these planets that we didn't necessarily expect to observe, or we didn't necessarily expect to observe them at such a like frequency or such a large amount. And so that is really starting to challenge our idea of some of our atmospheric models that we have currently. And I think we're really in this data rich regime right now. Like, we're actually at a point where we really need the modelers to catch up, or we need more people working in modeling in order to understand the things that we're looking at. Because lots of these obscurities are coming up where we're trying to fully understand what's going on. And there's lots of different components to that. Atmospheric models are very complicated, and they take, you know, there's a lot of physics under the surface, under the hood, so to speak. And but it's really exciting because it's really starting to challenge our conception of what these atmospheres look like. And JWST is really opening a new chapter on that and really helping us to understand different layers of atmospheres that we haven't been able to probe previously, and different molecular features, especially at those longer wavelengths. That mid-infrared regime that JWST is, you know, designed for and is perfect at, that's really where we're starting to see these obscurities of things that we perhaps didn't expect, or didn't expect to the level that we're seeing.
And so, do you think it's a planet in a situation that we just don't have here in the solar system? You know, if you have this planet that's incredibly close to the star, then you can have clouds of molten metal, and that makes sense. But is it also maybe strange chemistry that's behaving in ways that you weren't expecting?
I think, I guess it's not. It's strange chemistry in the fact that, like, you know, perhaps why is that molecule there in that amount at that, at given like the age of the system, for example. We're not seeing strange chemistry as in, like, I don't think anything is breaking our physics quite yet, but understanding, or at least not yet, I will say, but at least understanding why is that amount of molecule on this planet at this given time, and where did it come from, and what process is happening in order for that to be produced. Sometimes we see molecules that we would expect to be completely gone by the time a planet reaches a certain age, like irradiated because of its star, for example, because of its stellar host. It could come from things like, it could be signs of life, but it could also come from things like geological activity, or we could be probing just a wavelength that we haven't been able to really see before because we haven't had access to that wavelength regime with previous facilities, or that particular object hasn't been observed in that wavelength before. And then that could start opening up like a different layer of the atmosphere we're looking at, which gives us more clues to things like thermal inversions that are happening on the atmospheres of these planets, which is something that we need to take into account, and potential interactions between planetary interiors and their atmospheres that we haven't really been able to probe so much before. So, you know, strange chemistry, and strange is a really difficult word because it's not strange in the sense that like, well, we don't have the physics to explain that, but it's more like, okay, so this thing must be happening. We know the physics, but we need to understand what exactly is happening on this planet in order for that to come about.
Well, it's a fascinating time to be an exoplanetary researcher. Yes, Emily, really, thank you so much for your time, and good luck searching for Earth 2.0.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Emily Rickman. Now, we talked a bit about direct imaging of exoplanets, but Emily and I imagined potential spacecraft missions, ways to go much further into direct imaging. What is it going to take for us to be able to directly image planets orbiting around sun-like stars? And so if you want to see this longer conversation, special behind the scenes, you can definitely check that out over on patreon.com/universetoday. And this is just available free. You don't have to give us any money, but you can go over, sign up for Patreon, and then be able to watch that part of the episode. Now, I'm going to give you some additional resources, related interviews that I think you'll find really interesting. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew Gross, Bear Lake Roofing, David Gilton, and David Matz, Dennis Liberti, Dustin Cable, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Rohrbach, ScienceWorldRecord.org, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Krasaki, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our other supporters on Patreon. Now, there was a lot of concepts that came up during this conversation, and a lot of topics that I have done existing interviews about that I think you would find really interesting. Now, we're going to put the links down in the show notes because there's like too many to put links here up on YouTube. But I interviewed the people behind the coronagraph for the Nancy Grace Roman Telescope. I interviewed the people who are working on next generation ideas for the Habitable Worlds Observatory's coronagraph. I've also talked to people who are attempting to image planets orbiting around red dwarf stars, people who are working on trying to characterize the atmospheres of red dwarf stars. I've interviewed people who are working behind the Plato mission, the Gaia mission, as well as I mentioned Lee Feinberg, who is sort of one of the key people behind both Hubble and James Webb Space Telescope. So we have a lot of interviews that you can then follow and sort of build a more complete understanding of this topic, which obviously really fascinates me. All right, we'll see you next time.